This morning, we bring you one of our open mic segments. That's where we hand the mic to someone that we would usually be interviewing and let that person put questions to others. Today, our guest correspondent is Neil Gaiman, whose novels include The Graveyard Book, Coraline, American Gods, and Stardust. And Neil Gaiman, welcome to Morning Edition. And let me just jump in. I understand you're going to start us off by playing a recording.
I am. It's a bit old and crackly.
America, center of equal daughters, equal sons.
That's from 1890, and it's Walt Whitman, and it's his poem, America. So he would have been about 70 years old when he recorded it.
I wouldn't have even expected that Walt Whitman was recorded. And I know there must be a reason you decided to play it for us.
The main reason I thought we'd play it is the piece that I'm doing is all about audiobooks. And this is the earliest, as far as I know.
You think writers read their own words differently than someone else might?
I think some of us are really good, and I think some of us should never be allowed in front of a microphone at all. For me, it's one of the joys and privileges of being a writer is they let me record my own audiobooks. And it's, in truth, I think the part I enjoy the very, very most.
All right, then, why don't we get to it? Neil Gaiman's open mic.
I grew up in a world where stories were read aloud. My mother read to me. My father and grandparents invented stories. Some of my earliest memories were listening to stories on the radio as a boy in England. I had a record of Beatrice Lilly reading the poems of Edward Lear that I played until it was one long scratch.
Oh, WXYZ, what put it into your head to climb up this wall? My own darling, Mr. Discobolus.
I read aloud whenever I could. I would read to my sisters if they would sit still long enough. I still remember being played the original 1954 Under Milk Wood in English class and rejoicing in the words and the lilt of the voices.
To begin at the beginning. It is spring, moonless night in the small town, starless and Bible black. The cobble streets silent.
I didn't rediscover spoken word stories until I was a parent. I would read to my children and began to supplement that with cassette audiobooks. They made car journeys pass faster, and you knew you had a good one when nobody wanted to get out of the car at the end of a journey. I was overjoyed the first time one of my publishers let me record one of my own audiobooks, although slightly saddened when she explained that there would soon be no more audiobooks. Cassette tape players were vanishing from cars, packaging long books on CD was cost prohibitive. The audiobook was going to go the way of the dodo. But the death of the audiobook never happened. Author David Sedaris records his own audiobooks, which will come as no surprise to anyone who has heard his NPR pieces. When I decided to investigate the world of audiobooks, I started with David.
I'm a huge tapeworm. I think I heard my first one. It was one of those musty ones. You would find them at the library in boxes the size of a suitcase. They were actual tapes, and that's where I first started with audiobooks. I often believe that nobody could appreciate the iPod more than me. I think that it was invented especially for me. I would fight for my iPod. Like, I wouldn't fight for my freedom, but I would fight for my iPod.
But audiobooks can vary wildly. The person reading makes all the difference.
Like, I hate it when a guy is reading a book and he'll say, "There was a knock on the door. It was Rebecca." "Well, it's about time," she said. Like, that doesn't sound like a woman. It sounds like a drag queen.
The door opened. An attractive young woman walked forward. "Hello," she said. "What is your name?" "I'm really not changing my voice at all."
That's Martin Jarvis, an English actor. He's one of the leading readers of audiobooks and has a company that produces them. Martin's read hundreds of audiobooks, been thousands of characters.
"Sometimes I'll call upon an attitude of some of my old teachers. If there's a character of a rather pompous man, I will think of a man called John Branston. And he'll say, 'May I have a word with you?' Or a rather more steely person, there was a teacher, Dick Glyn-Jones. 'Come here, Jarvis. I have a bone to pick with you.'"
The process of recording an audiobook is a long one. It takes a good 3 days to record a medium-sized novel. There are pitfalls you really only discover when you're reading aloud, inadvertent tongue twisters or clumsy sentences that make you curse the author, which, for me, is me. And then there are other problems. Rick Harris is a longtime audio director.
There are actors who are just known for their loud stomach noises. Very talented Jerry Orbach came in to do something for me, and he had been up playing cards the night before. And I'd say his stomach noises were about as loud as his voice. But we've put, you know, blankets on people's stomach. You shift mic position. You cope.
And you do cope. My original publisher was half right. The cassette did fade away, but the audiobook didn't. Until this year and the recession and competition from electronic books, sales dropped, although things picked up in the summer. But one part of the market has continued to do well. Downloadable audiobooks. Books you can listen to on your iPod. Don Katz is the president of Audible.com, a leading online supplier of spoken word material. He is optimistic.
Absolutely think the audiobooks are getting better. The level of sophistication of the narrative formats, the ways that they're interpreted, the variants of kinds of formats, the decisions within the format, it's something that adds a whole layer of experience.
Of course, there are those who don't like audiobooks. Critic Harold Bloom said that deep reading really demands the inner ear as well as the outer ear. You need the whole cognitive process, that part of you which is open to wisdom. You need the text in front of you. I find that astonishingly unconvincing. I think you can have a close and perfectly valid relationship with the text when you hear it. But I've met a lot of people who, when asked if they've read a book, hesitate and say, well, I've listened to it. So is an audiobook a book? Audio producer Rick Harris again.
It is not a book. An audiobook is a separate entity. A novel can be seen as many things, and one of the things it can be seen as is a script for an audio performance. But it is another thing. It is an audio book that has its own validity, its own limitations, its own strengths. The human voice is unquestionably the most expressive musical instrument there is. Combine those two and you get an audiobook.
An audiobook is its own thing, a unique medium that goes in through the ear and sometimes leaves you sitting in the driveway to find out how the story is going to end.
And that's novelist Neil Gaiman on our open mic. You can practice your listening skills on our website, npr.org, where we have more of Neil's conversation with David Sedaris and Martin Jarvis. This is NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
I'm Melissa Block, and it's time now for All Tech Considered. As the temperature drops and all you lovers out there find yourselves snuggling on the couch or trying to lure a crush to the nearest mistletoe, we thought we'd offer this lesson in mobile manners. Here's NPR's Art Silverman on how to hold your lover as close as your smartphone.
Ah, modern romance.
I was actually out with a guy who had his phone on. I couldn't see it, but I could hear it. And I literally was like, do you want me to check that for you? Are you not hearing that beep?
That veteran of dates interrupted by digital data is Beth Hughes, here to report from the front lines of the battle to keep a potential mate's attention in the moment. Hughes is 31, a resident of Arlington, Virginia. She's single and searching for a guy who knows when to use and when to ignore his mobile device.
I was fishing in my purse for a tissue or something, and I looked over and I could tell that he was under the table, like James Bond texting, you know, or Blackberrying. And I was kind of like, do you really think that I don't see you over there? Kind of like trying to hide your paraphernalia from me. I really, that's kind of rude. You do not want to see a guy's paraphernalia, at least on the first or second date.
And that's just one of the rules that Beth Hughes has in her personal code of conduct for dates. Some others are no heavy texting, no blinking Blackberries at the bar, and no digital date making.
Midway through the date, first date, he pulls out his Blackberry and he's like, so when can I get on your calendar? When are you available? How about next Wednesday? I have something here. It's almost like he was using the Blackberry or the iPhone, whatever it was kind of showcasing his, like, tech savviness and the fact that he had a full calendar. And I was kind of like, it really was honestly a little bit of a turnoff.
Beth Hughes told the guy she'd get back to him. She didn't. Hughes is not alone in her desire to make the world safe from intrusion from mobile devices. But there are people who fall in love despite the barriers that handheld devices put up.
We met last year, right about the same time this iPhone came out.
Anushay Hussain fell for Shai Palavani just as he fell for his new mobile device. She lives in Arlington, Virginia, he in Washington, D.C. There's been an accepted menage a trois since then.
The iPhone has been this presence in our relationship.
At the beginning of our relationship.
But at the beginning of our relationship, he was on that iPhone like it was his job. I always used to joke, and I still say that his iPhone, Shai's iPhone, is the third person in our relationship.
And maybe there's a fourth. Anushay brings her own device to the relationship, a BlackBerry. They have everything worked out, sort of.
We'd be sitting on the couch and just watching TV, and I'll start talking to her, and she'll nod her head and as if she's listening to what I'm saying, and then I realize she's been on her BlackBerry the whole time.
I actually have picked up a lot of skills from him. He is a really big influence in my life as far as our mobile devices.
We're speaking to each other. You should put it away or acknowledge the fact that you're not just pretending to nod and you're into what the other person's trying to say.
You can do all this stuff and multitask. You know, women multitask all the time, so I'm genuinely listening to him and blogging. But I think the thing that irritates him is that, I mean, I'll even ask him to change the channel and I'll actually be, like, on my BlackBerry.
I think a BlackBerry is always cheating.
That's Brendan Greeley. Married, a father, he lives in Annapolis, Maryland. He's smart enough to recognize you can't split your loyalty.
You're either cheating on work, or you're cheating on your spouse, or you're cheating on home, or you're cheating on your kids. It's always cheating.
But Greeley avoids conflicts between his wife and his gadget. He does so by using a separate locale where his little keyboard won't be rude.
I told my wife, I just want you to know, I need you to know this first, but I'm going to tell America that I check my BlackBerry in the bathroom. It's true. You know, we're addicted to it. I think that's exactly why it's cheating. You know, you duck into the bathroom sometimes when you don't need to use it so that you can see what's happened. And I think that's exactly like having an affair, not that I would know.
All this confusion over how to behave when a BlackBerry or iPhone intrudes on relationships may get worked out over time. One day, an open marriage between one man, one woman, and many handheld devices may be the norm. No doubt our children and grandchildren will be taught the etiquette for balancing all this. Until then... Oh, just a sec. Facebook update. Oh my gosh. Deborah needs a ravioli recipe. Where was I? Until then, we'll have to make those rules up as we go along. Gotta go. I have to answer this one. Art Silverman, NPR News.
If you have a story about your mobile device getting in the way of romance, we would love to hear it. Just go to the All Tech blog and find Art's recent post called Handholding versus Handheld. You can leave your story in the comments section. That's at npr.org/alltech.
It's said that the ancient Greek inventor, Archimedes, figured out how to calculate a metal's density. It was his famous Eureka moment. The king of Syracuse had asked him to find out if the royal crown was made of solid gold. More recently, Oakland teenager Mark Anthony Waters of Youth Radio has faced a similar quandary. In this case, the jewelry in question is not a royal crown, it's a dental one, a fitted gold tooth covering, known in hip-hop parlance as a grill.
The first time I wore my grill, I was given a presentation under a projector light. As soon as I started talking, everyone was like, ah, and I was like, what's wrong with you people? And they said, your grill is blinding us. The grill blinded my mom, too.
Oh my goodness, that is ugly, that's tacky. What purpose does it serve other than the... you know, shock value or something.
Well, I wouldn't tell my mom this, but to me, the grill was like the ultimate symbol of masculinity and secretly substituted for what I felt was my lack thereof. But then my mom said,
is that really real?
Damn, my mom busted my bubble with that question. What if this thing is fake? I got even more worried about my grill when I talked to my coworker, Orlando, about his.
They implied when I bought the grill that it was real. They implied that it was 14-karat gold. And I knew there was something off because the top, my top grill and my bottom grill were slightly different color, yellow gold. So I knew that, you know, there was something a little fishy going on.
So, seeking the VIP treatment, Orlando and I bypassed the pawn shop and head up the hill to UC Berkeley. We showed our grills to geologist Kent Ross. Is today your first time seeing the grill?
Yes.
So I'll never come to UC Berkeley and find Kent Ross with the grill in his mouth?
I don't think so. I stay at home and read books a lot.
But he actually spends a lot of his time with an electron microscope. It looks like a small microwave. Ross sticks our grills inside, triggers the electron gun.
Electron beams make solid materials give off X-rays, and those X-rays tell you what elements are in the material.
And on a nearby computer screen, a series of peaks start to appear on a graph.
The bigger peaks are the more abundant elements. So the fact that the biggest peaks we see are the gold peaks indicates that there's a lot of gold in this area of this grill.
By this area, Ross means the grill surface. I want to know if the grill is solid gold. So Ross says we need to do a density test.
Okay, so I need to re-zero this.
It's an easy test. All we need to do is measure the weight of the grill in water, then in air, to find its density.
Density means weight per unit volume.
Then Ross checks our results against gold's established density.
I'm going to go into my office and look in a book and find out what the density of gold and copper and silver are.
While the density of my grill reveals that it's 14 karat through and through, Orlando's is just a little too light.
It looks like there has to be some low-density, cheaper core inside of it, and that the gold coated on the outside.
I'm crushed. Nah, man, like, I don't know. Like, I thought that, like, I didn't believe those people at all these gold teeth shops were selling solid gold grills. Like, you know, it is what it is. Fake it till you make it. Or just make it.
And now that I think about it, it would have been funny if my grill were fake. Like my alter ego dreams of transforming myself into a thug just because I got a grill. I realized using gold teeth of any kind, solid or plated, to change my life was ridiculous. I still don't want my intelligence assaulted by phony merchandise, but I'm no longer trying to prove my masculinity based on the things I buy or the sparkle off my smile. For NPR News, I'm Mark Anthony Waters. Baby, it's the Iceman powwow. Yeah. I got my mouth looking something like a disco bow.
Yeah. I got the diamonds in the ice. I'll hand see. Our program is directed by Greg Dixon, edited by Allison McAdam, and produced by Graham Smith. The technical director is Stu Rushfield. The engineering supervisor is Robert Jackson.
Our planning editor is Jerry Holmes. The staff includes Julia Buckley, Andrea Hsu, Gabe O'Connor, Carol Klinger, Chelsea Jones, Viet Le, and Rhonda Ray.
Our executive producer is Christopher Turpin. The managing editor for NPR News is David Sweeney. I'm Melissa Bloch.
And I'm Michelle Norris. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
And finally, we turn to a story that's been burning up the airwaves and the blogosphere, the questions surrounding golf great Tiger Woods' recent car accident. The actual case may be closed. Florida authorities announced on Tuesday that Woods would be cited for careless driving in the incident, which carries a $164 fine. No criminal charges are expected to be filed, but speculation about what happened is wide open. Woods crashed his SUV last Friday, hitting a fire hydrant and a tree in the wee hours of the morning near his Florida home. He cited injuries from the accident as the reason for withdrawing from this week's Chevron World Challenge, the golf tournament that benefits his foundation. But Woods has declined to speak to the police or to answer questions from fans and the media. In a statement, he characterized the incident as a private matter and asked for the public's understanding. We wanted to talk more about this, so we called Roy Johnson. He's editor-in-chief of Men's Fitness magazine, and he's interviewed Tiger Woods several times. Welcome, Roy. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Michelle. How are you?
I'm fine. Explain briefly, though, for people who don't follow sports, just how significant a player in the world of sports is Tiger Woods. In other words, why do we care so much what happened?
Well, he is the most significant athlete in the world. He is global. He has made millions and is projected to be the first billion-dollar athlete He has crossed racial lines in a sport that has a unique and twisted racial history. His importance to the sport cannot be truly quantified, and he has really changed the game of sports business more than anyone, certainly since Michael Jordan, and maybe as much as anyone ever.
And for such a public, such a prominent sports figure, is he very public generally? I mean, do we know a lot about him? Is he somebody who's very accessible generally?
We know about Tiger Woods essentially what he wants us to know about him. He has guarded his private life as much as any public figure and has been pretty successful at it. The interviews he has done, including mine and the times I've interviewed him through the years, were very specific and targeted. And when I was with him, he was always open about anything we wanted to discuss. So he picks and chooses his moments, but he doesn't do a lot of interviews outside of golf tournaments and with his relationship with Golf Digest. So we know about Tiger what he wants us to know.
He issued a brief statement about the accident on his website this weekend. He said, "The situation is my fault. It's obviously embarrassing to my family and me. I'm human and I'm not perfect. I will certainly make sure that this doesn't happen again. This is a private matter and I want to keep it that way." I want to ask you about that. Is that kind of classic Tiger, or does that have the flavor of kind of a managed situation? I do want to emphasize that he was not under any legal obligation to speak to the police, and I think that's an important point, that he is exercising his legal rights, and so people can have opinions about that, but that is the fact. But what about that?
Well, I think the answer is yes and yes. It was classic Tiger, a new age athlete who is speaking to the world through his own website, doesn't need a press conference, doesn't need reporters, doesn't need a spokesperson. Just type it into your own website. It is also classic Tiger in that it is managed and guarded. Very few people have probably seen the private Tiger, the one he is with friends and people that he trusts the most. So I'm not surprised that is the way he disseminated his message. And I'm also not surprised at the wording. It clearly sounds as if it is someone who is starting down a path of contrition, who is starting to perhaps try to take some personal responsibility, maybe trying to guard and protect his loved ones from various things, including the public things that already transpired in the accident, etc. So I don't believe, though, it's going to be the last that he's going to be able to have to speak about it. But I'm not surprised that is how he initially came out.
And finally, Roy, part of course, what's fueling the speculation is gossip. It has been alleged that there was a domestic incident at his home, which was perhaps sparked by some liaison outside the marriage. This has been kind of much discussed in the tabloids, of course, and has obviously the rumor has kind of penetrated the mainstream media. Now, some people are saying this is none of our business. You know, the only person hurt in this was him. It's none of our business. He has every right not to talk about it. But given that he is such a significant public figure, do you think that there will be pressure on him to talk more about this? He has endorsement deals worth millions. Do you think this will have an impact on his career? Very briefly, if you would.
Long term, I think Tiger will be fine. There's no question we live in a celebrity-driven world, and every celebrity is fair game, even when that celebrity is named Tiger Woods.
And do you think that this will affect the all his various endorsement deals and so forth? I know I'm asking you to speculate, but I am asking you to speculate.
I think in the short term, people, including his sponsors, will be watching and waiting, but I think they will be loyal to him, and as soon as he gets back out on the golf course, they will be right there beside him.
Roy S. Johnson is editor-in-chief of Men's Fitness Magazine. He joined us from his home office in New York. Roy, thank you once again.
Thank you.
And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.